So we do have a speaker this evening, I'm delighted to say. This individual agreed a very short notice last night that he would come along and share his experience with us, and hope was, I've got to be honest, other than the fact that he lives in Florida and he's been around the programme a few days, I don't know much about this man, other than the fact that he's been coming to our meetings over a period of time, and recently he's been turning up quite frequently, which is always nice to see. It's lovely to get regulars coming to our meetings. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say in his story of how he, you know, his journey to, into and through Narcotics Anonymous, his experience, strength and hope. So, Danny, I'm just going to hand it over to you, my friend. Please share with us 40, 45 minutes, whatever you're comfortable with. So the floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for asking. And my name is Danny and I'm an addict.
Hi, Danny.
Hi, Danny.
Hi, Danny.
So, just when I was, when I first got into Narcotics Anonymous, they taught me, when I tell my story or speak, they gave me the kind of use, and it's like, so where I came from, how I got to NA, and what it's like now. And I try to follow that little formula, no matter when I speak, where I speak, how I speak, or whatever. And, so I start off by telling you where I came from, and I was born in the late 1950s in New York City, and I was born in Brooklyn, which is a borough in New York City, and I was raised and lived for the first, until my mid-teen years, in the same neighborhood, which was also in the borough of Queens. So it was a neighborhood that was right on the New York and Brooklyn, New York. And it's New York. It was the New York City boroughs. They're part of the actual city of New York. And everything I did was in that locale. You know, I remember when I was a child, we used to have fun going down to the street that was the dividing line between Queens and Brooklyn. And some of the kids could stand on one side of the street, and the other kids could stand on the other side of the street. We'd yell back and forth at each other, things like, hey, how's the weather over in Brooklyn, and stuff like that, you know, little things to amuse ourselves as children. I was unathletic in any form, way, or means. I had no athletic abilities whatsoever. I was overweight, and, you know, my parents tried to get me involved in organized sporting stuff, but I just never was any good at it. You know, I participated or whatever, but I was just, you know, I was terrible, basically, you know. And I had something wrong with my arm and or shoulder, so that if I tried throwing a ball, I can't throw. And if you're a boy and you can't throw a ball, in where I grew up anyhow, And as a result, I had developed, on the street with the kids and everything, I developed low self-esteem. I didn't think very highly of myself. You know, everything in my life seemed like it pointed to the fact that I was less than. I was no good. You know, my mother was abusive, and she would constantly say things to me like, how could you be so stupid? And, you know, why did you do that? How could you be so stupid, over and over again? Plus, she was physically abusive on top of that. And, you know, this was the way I, you know, the life that I grew up in. And the first time I actually used on my own without being prompted in any form, way, or another was at a family function when I was about 11 years old. My oldest cousin was getting married, and they had his fiance had a big engagement party, and all the families were involved, you know, and all the families were invited. And I went there, and At the halfway point or so of this engagement party, you know, there was dancing, and there was a little cute little girl from the other family, and I was too bashful and shy to ask her to dance, and I suddenly started to, you know, I noticed all of these drinks that were left all over the place on tables and stuff like that, and they were, you know, pretty much finished drinks, so I started drinking all of the swill. You know, the sloshback of all of these drinks, and suddenly I was no longer afraid, and I liked the feeling of not being bashful. I liked the feeling of not, you know, being able to do things without you know, because I didn't care. You know, I didn't, I had liquid courage, you know, and that was the very first time. And it wasn't certainly the last time, you know, and as time wore on, you know, I basically, by the time I was 14 years old, I had become a daily user of a particular substance. And it just continued on. I joined the Army when I was 18 years old, and I did 4 years in the military. 2 years I was in Fort Rucker, Alabama, which was literally, they used to call it they call it L.A., Lower Alabama, you know, and it was you know, out in the real country and rural. And I was a, you know, kid that grew up in the city, you know, with subways and mass transit and everything. And then suddenly I'm out in you know, farmland and fields and stuff. And it was a culture shock, you know. But I spent 2 years there, and then I was shipped over to Germany. I spent 2 years in Darmstadt, Germany. And my using never stopped the entire time. I continued using the whole time and came back from the Army. And that was the only time I was ever really away from where I was, you know, raised and where I grew up. And then after that, I spent another, you know, by the time I was in my early 20s, after I got into the military, the drugs were no longer fun. You know, using was not fun. It had stopped being fun for some time, you know, and it became a full-time job. I had to do it. I had to use every single day, and I had to make sure I had enough to every single day, whatever, you know, however I needed, you know, whatever I needed to use for that day, I had to make sure I had it, you know. And every day was exactly the same as the next. Nothing ever changed. You know, everything revolved around using. You know, from the moment I came to the moment I passed out. You know, in fact, you know, people talk about their drug of choice, right? And I tell people towards the end, my drug of choice became passed out. Because I would, you know, come to in the morning, and I would use all day long, all night long, until I passed out. And when I passed out, it was the only time I didn't feel. And I had become suicidal. You know, I started doing all kinds of crazy things that would put myself in situations where, you know, I wouldn't kill myself outright, but I would put myself in all kinds of bizarre situations where I could have been killed in one form, way, or another, either via accident or because, you know, I crossed the wrong person or whatever the case may be. You know, I just did this kind of stuff over and over and over again because I hated life. I hated how I was, and it didn't change. Getting high was not fun, and it didn't feel good. I didn't like how I felt, which is the opposite of the way it was when I first used. You know, suddenly it was like, this is, you know, I had to do this. And I was introduced to the fellowship through a friend of mine who I'd used back out of the Army. We stayed friends, using buddies, basically, you know. And I went to go get high with him one day, and instead of getting high together, he told me that he was going to Narcotics Anonymous. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he said, do you know what that is? I said, no. He says, NA is like AA, except it's for people who use drugs and don't want to use drugs anymore. And I was like, oh, I kind of maybe had an idea of what he was talking about, you know, but he says, well, I'm going to a meeting. Do you want to come? I says, but I want to get high. He says, I don't care what you want to do or what you're going to do. He says, I'm leaving in about 15 minutes. If you want to come along, you can come along. So he did what he had to do, and 15 minutes later he came. I did what I had to do, and 15 minutes later he came out, and he asked me if, you know, do you want to go to the meeting? I says, okay, I'll go. And I went to the meeting, and I was high as a kite. And I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And he, you know, we went there. And I wish I could tell you I remember everything about the meeting. I remember it was very small, which for an in-person meeting, at some point since I've been clean, this was a small meeting. There was 10, 12 people there. And they all sat around a table. In a circle around a table. And I remember the person who was leading the meeting say, if you use today, please don't share, because we want to hear from you. We don't want to hear from the drugs. And so when they opened up the, they had somebody speak. And when they opened up the sharing, they said, we're going to go around the table and everybody can share. When it gets to you, you can share. And when it got to me, I didn't know what to say or what to do or anything. You know, it was my first meeting I was at. And so it got to me, and I arrogantly pushed my chair back and stood up and said, my name's Danny. I'm a garbage head, and I got high just before I came to this meeting. And I figured this is the point where they show me the door, you know. This is the point where they throw me out. Because I was used to that kind of stuff. You know, I was used to getting thrown out of bars and this, that, and the other thing. I was, you know, for being arrogant and acting out. And instead, almost as if in unison, in one voice, they said, Danny, we love you. Keep coming back. We're glad you're here. And that was a completely different reaction than I had anticipated or thought was going to happen. People came up to me and they gave me hugs and told me to keep coming back and whatnot. And that was like the first idea of that, you know, something was different. Something about this was completely different. And that's the only stuff that I really remember about the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You know, I hadn't really physically touched anybody for a couple of years at that point, you know, other than a handshake, you know, hey, how you doing? Manly shake, you know, handshake, you know. Other than that, I didn't hug people. I was kind of dirty. I was a biker's biker. You know, I liked being dirty. I liked being greasy and dirty looking. And it was a way of keeping people at bay. You know, it was a way of keeping people away from me. You know, I didn't like people. I was afraid of people, and I didn't like them. But I didn't want to show people I was afraid of them. So I created this facade, this mask, and it worked perfectly to keep people away from me. You know, I didn't smile. You know, I rode the motorcycle everywhere and did everything by motorcycle. And it was a way of keeping people away from me, you know. And so my friend says, what do you think? I says, well, I'm glad for you. He says, no, what about you? He says, well, I don't know if I'm ready for that there, you know. And you know, like I said, I've been suicidal for the past three years, trying to kill myself because every day was the same. But so now I'm offered the opportunity to try something different. And I'm saying, I don't know. I don't know if it's for me. I don't know if I should do this. You know, and he said, well, okay, you know, if you want to go to meetings, just call me. Go to a meeting. And we'd go to meetings, you know. And about a month later, you know, situation arose, and it was just a crazy story and crazy things that happened. And I called my friend up and said, look, I want to try going to those meetings. Just, you know. I put myself in a situation where I not only was almost killed myself, but I almost killed 50 other people because I drove a bus at the time. And luckily, there was no accident. Nobody got hurt. And, you know, but it frightened me really badly. And I was like, I thought to myself, look, it's one thing if I want to kill myself, but I don't want to kill anybody else. You know, and so he said, okay. So I started, you know, at that time, they would give out the white chip at every meeting, and we actually gave out poker chips because they were really inexpensive. and anybody could get a white chip to surrender on a daily basis, you know. And they would ask people with new people with, you know, how many, if you have less than 90 days clean, you want to share your clean time, you know. And we'd go around and share our clean time, and I would say things like, you know, my name's Danny, I'm an addict, I got 30 days clean, and I feel like shit today. And that's basically what I ever said at meetings, you know. I didn't share. I just, you know, I felt terrible for a long time, physically felt terrible. But I kept coming, and they told me to keep coming. And somewhere along the way, it was a real hot, hot day, and I was driving the school bus with no air conditioning. And I remember ending the route, and I went down the street, and I went into this little, in New York, we call a bodega. It's a little, you know, little convenience store. Street side convenience store, and I walked in and I ran in and I grabbed a little 8-ounce bottle of beer, and I, you know, paid for it, and I ran out and got into the bus and started driving again, and I sucked that ice cold beer down, and the disease started working overtime, because the disease starts telling you don't want to get high, you don't have to get high, you can just take that one and you're fine, you know. And I never told anybody, I didn't tell anybody that I did that, you know. And I had been coming to the meetings for, you know, quite some time at that point, and had kept hearing at the meetings that alcohol is a drug. Alcohol is a drug, you know, and that people relapse by using alcohol. But I didn't tell anybody. I didn't want to tell anybody. I was ashamed. And so I didn't tell anybody. And I kept coming and counting my clean time and stuff. And then I went to this, I wanted to go to this party. Right? I knew everybody was going to be using. And I told people in the fellowship basically the same thing. They said, Danny, if you go to that party, you're probably going to use. And I told every single one of them, you don't understand. You don't know. You don't understand. I don't want to use. So I'm not going to use, you know. And they were like, okay, well, you know, we love you. Keep coming back. And I went to the party, and I didn't want to use at the moment that I used. I had no desire whatsoever to use, and I used anyhow. And it was in that moment, at that time, when I realized what I had just did, that I recognized that my will, has nothing whatsoever to do with this. And it was probably the first time I ever experienced what they were talking about, the idea of powerlessness. You know, I have no control over this disease. You know, and if I put myself in situations, I will use whatever the situations may be. You know, and I made a decision following that thing that I did. And it just so happened that this was the day before my actual belly button birthday. So my clean day and the same. You know, I've been clean since September 1st, 1985. And I recognized that when I shared about it, talked with people about it afterwards, and I suddenly started to realize that if I don't start taking the suggestions that we offer in the fellowship, the suggestions that come from the experience of people not using and the experience of people who did the wrong thing often, if I don't start taking those suggestions, I will continue to do that over and over and over and over again. You know, and the simple little suggestions like make a meeting every day. You know, our basic text says in the chapter, what can I do? Says, you know, make a meeting, make at least a meeting every day for 90 days. At least a meeting, at least one. Doesn't mean I can't make two or three or whatever, you know, but at least a meeting a day for 90 days, you know. And when I ask people about what's the point of that, and they said, well, first of all, it gives you a foundation, you know, and you'll get to know people, and people will get to know you. You know, you'll develop relationships with other people. You know, back then, the meetings were relatively small. Rarely did we have a meeting that was, you know, much. Most meetings were smaller than 20 people, you know, and I would go to the meetings and I would see the same 10, 15, 20 people at every single meeting, every night of the week, every day. And as a result, I started to get to know people and they started to get to know me and I started to develop some trust and stuff like that. And they said, get a sponsor. And I wish I could say sponsorship has been for me, but it's been a struggle my entire time clean, you know. My first year clean, I had three different sponsors, and oddly enough, they all had the same first name. Every one of them was named John, so I had three sponsors, you know, first John, second John, and third John, but each one of them gave me something. My first sponsor, again, the fellowship was very small in 1985 in New York City, and the best reason I can give, even though New York City is a very large place and there's lots and lots of people, you know, when you add up all of the surrounding, you know, localities and everything, it's probably, at that time, there were probably 15 million people in the metropolitan area, you know. So if I say I would go to meetings with 20 people and there wasn't a whole lot of meetings, you know, and it says what's available, you know, and there wasn't a lot of people with a lot of clean time when I got clean, you know. If somebody had a year or two years or more, it was like they had a lot of clean time. Most everybody else had less than a year clean. You know, my first John, he had only had 90 days clean. But one of the things he taught me was how to become an open book, how to open up and share. He said, he told me as a suggestion that you need to go to every meeting you go to, you need to raise your hand and share whether you think you have anything to say or not. You know, now I know that there are people, I've heard this over and over again. There's people say that when I first came around, they told me to sit down and shut the expletive up. And you know, and I recognize there are some people that need to be told that. Some people need to be told to be quiet because they don't have, you know, they're going to just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, you know. And but other people, there's other people who need to be told to open up. They need to be told that they need to share. You know, I was a very closed up person. I didn't want anybody to know anything about me. I was afraid if I let you get to know something about me, that you would use it against me, that you would take that information and hurt me with it. You know, that was why I liked the facade of being a biker's biker, you know, with the Harley Davidson and all of that stuff. You know what I mean? It was a way of keeping people away. And I liked keeping people away because if you got inside of me, if I let you inside of me, you would hurt me. You would get to know me and you would use things against me. And he told me I needed to let people, hold on just a second. He told me I needed to let people get to know me and share at every single meeting if possible. And I tried, you know, sometimes they wouldn't pick me to share. They just would go by throw their hands. And anyhow, that was what I got from him. Second John was about service. And he got me involved in service, and I started doing stuff with a committee called Public Information at that time, which has now become Public Relations based on the 11th tradition. And it was not teaching about, you know, letting people outside the fellowship know about it. I'm really sorry about my dog barking. I put him out of the room, but unfortunately, it's probably in the background, and there's nothing I can do to stop this at this time. You know, there's a bird in the next room, and he is just barking at that bird, and there's nothing I can do about it. So hopefully it's not too disturbing. It'll be on the recording. Okay, yay. So anyhow, third John was about working the steps, and I started working the steps through him, and it was really about spirituality, coming to know the first three steps I worked with him, and coming to know this power greater than myself, you know. And that's what I did, you know. I came to know, I started to work the steps, and I came to believe, and I started this relationship with the power greater myself, which for me was amazing because I was an atheist when I came to Narcotics Anonymous. I was a professing atheist. You know, I didn't believe in anything, you know, and they told me to keep coming, you know, and that I needed to find a power greater than myself that I could believe in. And then I found a power greater than myself. Even then I put faith in, you know, hope and faith. And I kept coming. I stayed, you know, they said make a meeting a day for 90 days. And I did. And actually, when everything was said and done, I think I made a meeting every day for the first 5 years clean. At least a meeting. Some days I would make two or three if I had an opportunity. There was some daytime meetings I could go to. And on the weekends, there was daytime meetings I could go to. And then, there was a meeting every single evening, you know, somewhere nearby where I lived, and I would just, you know, make meetings, and I continued to be involved in service. You know, I had a home group, my very first home group. I joined that home group was because it was underneath, it was in the basement of a large Roman Catholic church. Underneath the church itself, it was in the basement of the church itself, and when you'd walk through the door, the floor, it had been like a fellowship hall or something at one point. But they, for whatever reason, they tiled the floor they had these 1 foot by 1 foot square tiles, and they were opposing colors. One was green and one was orange. And it was it was laid out like a chessboard, but the colors played tricks on my mind and made me feel weird when I walked through the door. It was like I had to walk funny. I had to lift my legs and my feet funny because it had an optical illusion the way they were laid out. And that was the very reason I chose that to be my home group, because it made me feel weird physically, you know. But I had a home group, and they suggested that I get involved with the home group and do service. And the first thing they did was they taught me how to make coffee, and they gave me the key to open the place up. And I would go there and I'd set up, and I had to get there like at least an hour early before the meeting. because we had this big, huge coffee pot, and it would take like 45 minutes to an hour to brew the coffee. And if you didn't have the coffee ready, it was bad. People really would get upset if the coffee wasn't ready, you know. And, you know, we'd have cookies and stuff like that. Plus, back then, we smoked in meetings. There was no such thing as a non-smoking meeting. Everybody smoked, and which is weird, because I was a non-smoker. I didn't smoke cigarettes. And I would sit there in this cloud of smoke, you know. But you'd have to put out the ashtrays, and then after the meeting, we'd have to clean the ashtrays and put them away, and we'd have to sweep the floor, because when people smoke, they get ashes everywhere. So you have to, you know, sweep the floor, which you'll hear people, old-timers, refer to the ABCs of recovery, you know. And they'd say, and it's ashtrays, brooms, and chingers. You set the chairs up, and you have to sweep the floor, and you have to set up the ashtrays, and you have to clean them up and put them away until it's over with. And that's the ABCs of recovery, and that making coffee. You know, I learned how to make a good cup of coffee as a result of that. And I'd never made coffee a day in my life beforehand, you know. And I kept coming, and then I became, you know, secretary, and I became a GSR. I chaired the meeting. I became a GSR. And, you know, I got involved in different levels of area service, and I was always about being of service or doing some kind of a service. It took a while to learn how to be of service, I should say. Yeah. Doing service and being of service are two different things. When I do service, I tend to be doing it because it feeds my ego and my self-esteem. But if I'm of service, it's a more spiritual connection for me. I don't know how it works out for me. You know, it's like, you know, somebody asked me to do something and I try and do it, you know. There are things that I won't do. I won't do hospitals and institutions. I'm not particularly good at it. I had some bad experiences early on doing hospitals and institutions. I was chairing a meeting in a psychiatric facility, lockdown psychiatric facility, and I ended up having to quit the meeting because I felt unsafe. There was, you know, it would put me in a situation that I felt very, very vulnerable with there was a female, whatever you want to call it, patient that, you know, was just, she started being very inappropriate. And I was the one that was vulnerable to being arrested. And I was like, nope, I can't do this. I don't want to get myself in a situation where I go to jail because somebody's feelings get hurt. And I had to give the commitment up, you know. And jails, I'd never really done any time in jail, so I always felt very uncomfortable in jail meetings because, you know, it's like strength and hope, but a lot of times people want to hear that rough and tumble, and they want to hear that somebody's been inside and what it's like, and I can't share that. I don't know this. I know what it's like to have been in the Army. You know, I know what it's like to have used and not liking myself. I know what it's like to not like myself, but I don't know what it's like to have been in jail. I never spent any time in jail, you know, and so it wasn't a good brand fit for me. The other thing is, I was an area treasurer, and I would be so stressed out over trying to keep the books for an area that had a budget of about $3,000 to $3,500 a month on hand that they use for one thing or another, and plus their fruit reserve, and it stressed me out terribly. And as a result, I don't balance my checking account anymore. You know, I just make sure I have a lot of extra money in the checking account so I don't have to worry about notes and books, you know. And that's stuff that I learned as a result of doing service. You know, I kept on coming. I've been involved all along. You know, I've sponsored people. I said that I haven't had a good situation with sponsors, you know. And I said just the first year I had three different sponsors. And then after that, I had another sponsor that really helped me walk through the steps. And then he ended up using, and I felt hurt. He's the one that hurt himself. But I felt hurt because I felt abandoned. You know, and it had nothing to do with me. He didn't use because of me. You know, he used on his own. But I was the one that felt hurt. And it took a long time of working with other sponsors and working through the stuff to recognize that it had nothing to do with me, you know. And it took a while before I got another sponsor because of the feelings of abandonment, you know. It took a while before I was willing to ask somebody else to be my sponsor. I moved to Atlanta before I asked another person to be my sponsor. I moved to Atlanta about 30 years ago. And when I got there, I struggled looking for a person to be a sponsor. And I finally found this guy that I really liked. And he was an African-American gentleman. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And I really liked the stuff. His name was Plez. And the one thing he left with me that still sticks to me is, you know, when you got stuff going on in your life, like you've got going on, he says, it sounds like a whole lot of jazz. He was really into jazz music. He says, sounds like you got a whole lot of jazz going on in your life. And he says, but you know, there's something really interesting about jazz. He says, jazz can turn into the blues with the snap of a finger. And, you know, that made a lot of sense to me for whatever reason. You know, I heard that, and I listened to what he said, and I tried to keep it where it's at, you know, with that. And he ended up dying of brain cancer. You know, he was my sponsor for a little over a year, and he had brain cancer, and he died. And that was the first sponsor I had that died since I've been clean, and it wasn't the last. You know? It took a little while for me to find another sponsor again. And I met this guy, I'd heard about him, he was like a really known throughout Atlanta, and he had a particular meeting, he was started going there, and I really liked the guy. And he had an accent, he was from Atlanta, he lived in Atlanta, and he was probably from Atlanta most of his life. But his second accent made him sound like the cartoon character Foghorn Leghorn from Looney Tunes. And he kind of spoke like that, and he talked like that, and it was like, I liked the way he talked, you know, and he'd been clean for quite some time, and I identified with aspects of his experience, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and we'd get together every Tuesday night, and we'd have, you know, dinner after the meeting, and we'd talk, and sometimes it was just he and I, and other times it was a group of people, but I developed a really good relationship with him, and after about 6 years, I noticed something was changing. I didn't know what it was. And he got lost one day. After the meeting, he couldn't find the bathroom. He couldn't find the men's room in the meeting. And this is a meeting that he'd been going to for a long, long time. And it turns out he had Alzheimer's disease. And he ended up dying of Alzheimer's disease. And that was the second sponsor I had that died. And it was shortly around that time that I got to meet the next sponsor that I had, and I identified a lot with him. He had gone away from the fellowship for some time and came back and felt very isolated. He lived in the Navajo Nation out in the deep far west of the United States, and it was a place where, you know, it was like really isolated. This was long before we had internet service, you know, and telephone, the cell phones really weren't available out there at that time. So he was very isolated for several years. And when he came back, I could identify with that isolation and how he shared about it in meetings. And he and I just started a relationship, and I asked him to be my sponsor several times. And he's my sponsor for close to for 20 years, at least 20 years. I can't really remember the actual amount of time. And he passed away this past January. He was diagnosed with a form of dementia, Alzheimer's, called Lewy bodies a few years ago. And it's a disease that they refer to as the slow goodbye. And he passed away from it this past January. And that's been a very tough journey for me. Because to have our sponsor for 20 some odd years, I developed a very close relationship with him. Not that I didn't call him all the time or every day, or even sometimes we'd call him. You know, I'd see him at meetings, and we'd go out to dinner and stuff like that. And we worked the steps on a basis. In fact, we were in some working groups with other sponsees and whatnot together. We worked the steps together in a community situation for some time, two or three times actually. And so we had a very deep relationship. And, you know, sometimes he and I would just go do things and go on, you know, to do things together and sightsee and, you know, go to carnivals and stuff just to spend time and to know one another. And it was a very deep deep, long-term relationship. And when he passed away, it's a hard relationship to lose, and it's a hard relationship to find somebody else to become my sponsor. And I recently asked somebody else to be my sponsor that I've met in the last few years through online meetings, and, you know, I'm trying to develop that relationship. And it's just, it's a journey, like anything else, you know. I've had a lot of people that I've been friends with and known for a long time who've passed away since I've been clean, you know. And sometimes it seems like every meeting I go to, something will be said, somebody will share something, and I'll identify with something about, and I'll think of so-and-so, and it's like, oh, yeah, they're dead, you know. And it's like, I don't know if this is something that's, you know, I've been clean a long time, you know, and I'm getting older. And my sponsor, who passed away in January, he would say whenever they'd ask him, they'd give him his medallion, you know, or they'd give him his chip when he'd come up on another year clean. He'd have had 48 years. And every year they'd give him, and people would say, how did you do that? You know, and he'd say, you know, for several years I would hear him say the same thing. You know, if people asked him, he says, well, it was just two things. The only two things I had to do was not use and not die. You know, and it was that simple. Now, recovery, he would say, is a different thing. Recovery comes as a result of working the steps, because recovery comes from the changes that come internally as a result of working the steps. You know, I am a different person than I was when I stopped using. You know, I don't know if I'm really open today, but I'm a whole lot more open than I ever was. You know, I've had a lot of experience in life with not using, and I can share that experience today. You know, sometimes it's painful, but I've had a lot of really good experiences too. I've been to a lot of world conventions. You know, I've had the opportunities to, you know, go to all kinds of events and have fun. And, you know, I'm just, it's a journey that's mixed of life, you know. You know, my girlfriend, best friend, whatever you want to call it, roommate, last year she passed away. And that was another tough situation. It was last November, actually. She, you know, that was another tough situation to live through, you know. And at the same time, the house that we lived in caught fire. So it's like, things were really hard last year, you know, but thankfully, through the help of the fellowship and because I have this higher power that takes care of me no matter what, you know, it's okay. You know, I have a room that I rent from somebody that's in the fellowship, and life is okay. You know, about a little over a month ago, you know, I would use my car to deliver Amazon for the last 2.5 years. And it was how I make extra money because I'm retired, you know, from Marine Security. And about a month and a half ago, I was sitting at a traffic light and somebody ran into the back of me and totaled my car. And as a result, I lost a third of my income. And I have no car, no money to buy another car. And I'm not making the money that, you know, I can barely have enough money now to, you know, pay the bills and, you know, have a little something to eat. And it's tough, but you know what? I still have a higher power that's taking care of me. You know, my higher power has never stopped taking care of me, and it's not never going to stop taking care of me. Every situation is something that I can learn and I can grow through. Is it going to stay like this? Well, I can tell you from my experience that nothing stays the same. Nothing stays the same. It's just what I'm going through right now. You know, I don't know how long it's going to last, and it doesn't matter. When it changes, it changes. You know, and I've had good things, good times, and I've had bad times. Right now, I'm not in one of the best times there's ever been, but it's okay. You know, it's okay. So I assume that I have shared for near 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes. And with that, I want to thank everybody for helping me stay clean. And I turn the floor back over to our chairperson. Thanks, Steve.